Welcome to My Life as a Landlord, where we educate curious U.S. and Canadian landlords, answer rental questions, and clear up confusions about all things housing. If you're looking for some landlord education, interesting guests, and awkward conversations, you've come to the right show. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Salisbury. This is My Life as a Landlord. Welcome to it.
Hello there. Thanks for joining me today on My Life as a Landlord. I am Dr. Jen, and today we are talking about the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies American Rental Housing 2024 report. I'm so excited for you joining me today. I am super happy to go over this study, and we're going to talk all about different results in the study. We're going to talk about the study itself. I wanted to do this this podcast in January, but time got away from me, so here we are. But by the way, there is a similar study for Canada. So for my Canadian listeners out there, I will be doing another podcast that is for Canada and the different provinces in Canada. But in business, you must know your numbers. And so it all goes back to the source documents, and what better source documents are than from research. This is why it's really important that you understand on a very critical, basic level, what are the source documents telling you as real estate investor and ultimately as a landlord. So in business, you must know your numbers. But the trends predict the numbers, and which in real estate, that is what we do our projections on. As Wayne Gretzky said, skate to where the puck is going to be, not where the puck is. And by the way, if you want to read along with me in as I go through this study, you certainly can. There is a PDF of the study on my website, mylifeasalandlord.com. If you are listening to this and something intrigues you, I highly encourage you go through the PDF yourself. So here's how I'm going to do this. This is kind of interesting because I usually have a guest on the show. This is first time in a long time that I've just done a show by myself. So I'm going to go over several things with you. Notably, I'm going to tell you about the study itself, the study that Harvard University did. Then we're going to go over some of the conclusions. And then what on earth do we do with all this information, right? So let's get to it. So the study itself, the study is actually pretty quick. It's 52 pages in 7 sections. They put out one every single year, and they change it up based on market conditions, which is understandable. The first section is an executive summary, which I will be using primarily to help with the summary today, but there is a lot more details in there. Other sections are much deeper dives into renter households, the housing units themselves in the rental fleet, or as they noted, the rental stock, rental markets, rental affordability, the challenges in rental housing, and then the last section, section 7, is additional resources. And Harvard also has some online tables and exhibits that are not directly in the study, and it's great that they have other resources, so you can go to their website and check them out, which is really cool. All right, so some of these results that are in the study will not surprise you at all, but I'm going to give you the numbers on this when we get to it. Some of the numbers surprised me. So there is a high demand for starter houses, so people that are moving out on from their parents' home for the first time, as well as folks that are downsizing / empty nester homes, people who are retiring, their kids have moved out, and they don't need that big house. They just want something small for themselves. Huge demand for that. Also high demand for affordable homes for low and medium income wage earners. These are the most in demand. We're going to talk a lot about these smaller units that are low and medium income wage earners are looking for, because they're not looking for big units that are expensive with granite countertops and a dishwasher and all that. They're not looking for that. They're looking for affordable. The numbers of low rent units has fallen by 2.1 million of these low income units, low rent units have fallen in the last decade. So in the last 10 years, either those low rent units have been converted, they've been renovated, or they've been demolished, or they've been converted to something else. Maybe a wall got knocked down and they've been, you know, moved into a bigger house or something like that. So, but 2.1 million units in the last decade have been lost. Rent increases are outpacing income gains. So as rents go up yearly, but does your income go up yearly with it? Probably not. In fact, the answer is no. Rent increases are going up steadily, wage increases are not. Last week, David Pickler on episode 67 noted how high inflation is. And even with it going down a bit now, prices are still super high at the grocery store, at the gas pumps. Basically, everything you're buying is still super high. And as a result, in this study, unaffordability has hit an all-time high. Holy moly, that's crazy. Unaffordability has hit an all-time high. Okay, so one of the things I'm going to start pulling in from other research units that have supported this study, and I really love how Harvard has pulled them all together. So here's the first one. According to the Economic Policy Institute, a single person household in the most affordable counties, needs about $2,000 per month to cover everything but housing. And then you add the rent. So just for a single person living in the most affordable counties in the United States, just $2,000, not including rent, is what an individual needs to live. Wow. Our life has gotten very expensive. Holy cow. Okay. So let's talk about how the government has stepped in to help with rent. Now, there was a lot of rent programs that happened during COVID. Unfortunately, a lot of those rent programs are no longer in force. And one of the results that Harvard noted was that rental assistance programs are not an entitlement. So basically it's not like Social Security. It's not when you reach a mile marker in your life that you automatically get it and it's an entitlement. Rental assistance programs are not an entitlement. You have to qualify for them. And unfortunately, government rental assistance programs only serve 1 in 4 income eligible households. And we'll talk about why here in a minute. So there's something called housing choice vouchers. Housing choice vouchers is a way that the government helps with rent, paying for rent. And so housing choice vouchers are another crucial housing subsidy facing challenges. Vouchers, government helping with rent. Vouchers assisted 2.3 million households in 2022. Which covered the gap between the 30% gap between a household's income and the area's fair market rent. So the households are not earning enough money and the market rents are too high. And so these vouchers cover that gap. This subsidy, however, relies on participation of public market landlords like you and me, who are not required to accept the vouchers in the first place. The vouchers can be a little bit complicated. And so people maybe don't want them. About 40% of people who receive the voucher, this is the tenants, 40% of people who receive the voucher are unable to use it because there is a very fast timing between when a unit is available, getting qualified, excuse me, and the short time to sign a lease. A landlord does not want a unit to sit empty for any longer than it has to be. And so if someone is using a voucher, it can take a long time for someone to use a voucher. So unless those private landlords are willing to either wait or it's just naturally in the timing of getting qualified, this can be a detriment to the people who are using the voucher. So that can also be a problem with it. So remember, nearly a third, this is amazing, nearly a third of renters that had a household income under $30,000 in 2022. Let me say that again. Nearly a third of renters in 2022 had a household income of under $30,000 annually. That equates to $15 per hour for the entire household. Oh my goodness. Let's talk about the rental units themselves. The study was pretty clear. The rental fleet is older than it ever has been. The median age of a rental unit is 44 years old in 2021, which in 2001, the average age of rental stock at that time was 34 years old. So now, 20 years later, if those same units in the fleet, they would be 54 years old. Now the median age is 44 years old. So that's telling you that some of the units have either been completely renovated or torn down or very likely combined with new rental units concurrently. One of the things the study brought up is maintenance and upkeep of the existing units that we do have is another huge problem that no one is talking about. In 2022, 835,000 households in the U.S. has a maintenance backlog estimated at $90 billion with a B, $90 billion. This is ultimately going to result in ending tenancy at some point for these households to either renovate or demolish these units potentially. Now, if we're talking minor maintenance, they should be doing annual maintenance. But the units are getting older and maintenance is not getting done. Accessibility. Rapidly growing population of older adults will increase the demand for accessibility features, things like elevators, things like ramps, handhold bars, all kinds of different things. Given that accessibility needs typically increase with age. As our population ages, we need more accessible units and accessible items in those units. Other notes, the study included the impacts on housing, including things like climate change, things like renovating to energy efficient materials in the rentals, and rental units that are energy insecure. Very interesting. This study was really, really detailed. Further, the location of these rental units impacted the renters that lived there. The term rental deserts, quote unquote, was used in the study, which I had never heard before. Rental deserts tend to be located in suburban areas which have restrictive land use policies and make it difficult to build multifamily housing, which is predominantly rented to renters. In 2021, suburban neighborhoods constituted 55% of census tracts nationally, but 68% of neighborhoods were less than 20% of the stock to rent. So basically, suburban areas are way more prone to single family homes, subdivisions, not necessarily multifamily apartment buildings. And so you're pushing renters in these apartment buildings further and further out than from the city centers. Okay, well, what about talking about building new units? Let's talk about that. Mike and I are developers. We're builders. We've got a couple of projects that we could work on in Canada. We've got a development permit. We were trying to build some apartment buildings. But here's what the study says is impacting it, and I have to agree. High interest rates have depressed market activity, which means the cost to acquire multifamily properties or to build them has pushed most developers to wait for multifamily. And that's exactly the scenario that Mike and I are in. Multifamily mortgage borrowing was down over 48% year over year in the second quarter of 2023, meaning multifamily building has stopped. It's been cut in half because they're not lending. And I don't know too many developers that are building on cash. There are some, I'm sure. Okay, while the pipeline of units under construction should help provide new supply in the near term, declining multifamily starts could worsen the existing supply shortage, especially as you get more and more further out in starting more multifamily projects. Additionally, local regulation and zoning laws constrain multifamily construction in many neighborhoods. Nationally, an estimated 75% of the land in major cities is zoned exclusively for single-family homes. Let me say that again. Nationally, an estimated 3/4 of the land in major cities is zoned for single families. Several states are taking proactive measures to allow higher density even on single-family zone lots. We also see this in British Columbia, and it is proposed in Hawaii as well. But there's a number of states, including Montana, Vermont, Washington, California, Maine, Oregon, and many others are following because zoning reform and higher density on existing single family will help us, but it's going to take time. And also one other caveat, while zoning reforms do not guarantee the construction of new multifamily housing, they can remove a significant barrier. As a developer and a contractor, zoning reforms and faster permit times incentivizes building. If we know that we're going to have permits at certain times and certain things, then that's the least amount that we have to hold a property. And the longer a developer has to hold a non-revenue generating property, the more interest is paid out without funds coming in. If that hold time can be shortened, the costs can go down and the builders are more likely to build. All right, let's talk about the last part of the study, Table A1. Very interesting. Talked about the characteristics of U.S. rental households between 2010 and 2022. Now, they had several sections in this table, but 3 points in time for the table itself. So 2010, 2019, and then 2022. I'm not sure why there were only three, but there were. And further, the table is broken out into several sections, including age groups that are in the households, household income, housing cost burdens, educational attainment of those households, which surprised me, and then the household type, whether people were married with or without children, a single person, a single parent, etc. So there are some very interesting trends I found in this table. Here's just a few I noted, and I'm sure there are more. So the age of the household, most notably for me, was 65 or over. In 2010, there were 5.3 million renters in this age group, but by 2022, there were 7.6 million renters in the same age group, which looks like empty nesters are leaving their big homes and renting. Educational attainment of the household. The different levels of this section was either no high school diploma, then a high school diploma, some college, bachelor's degree, and then graduate professional degree, which is where I am. In 2010, the graduate professional degree group made up 2.9 million renters, but by 2022, it had almost doubled to over 4.8 million. And the high wage earners can either not afford to buy a house or they don't want to, so they rent. One more, household type. Single person household in 2010, there were more than 14.6 individual renters, but by 2022, almost 18 million individuals were renting. I don't know what's causing that, but I'm assuming that's because partly by millennials moving out. There's a lot more in this study. If you want to see more details, if something struck your curiosity, I highly recommend you read the study yourself and check out the data that Harvard University has put together. Very impressive. Really, really found it very simple. It's not that long. So again, what do we do with this information now? So there's several things that you can do. You can talk to your local legislature about increasing incentives for developers to build more housing, changing zoning requirements, faster permit times, and about higher density, among many other things regarding housing. But what do we do with our own rentals? After all, if you're listening to this podcast, chances are you probably are a landlord. Well, it sounds like annual maintenance is something that not every landlord does, and that's important with your aging units. If when local legislators allow higher density, knowing that more individuals are renting than ever before, can you take one of your larger units and legally break it into two or three units? What do you do with this information? You become innovative in your local area. Educate yourself on what these numbers mean for you. And while it appears the interest rates are going to be coming down in 2024, there may be more multifamily housing starts coming in your local area. And when those units come online, think about how that's going to impact your existing rentals. Maybe it won't impact it, but maybe it will. So here's your call to action, all you listeners out there. Read this study. This is really interesting stuff. Harvard University put this together, but you can Google it. But better yet, you can go right to my website, mylifeasalandlord.com, and read it. There may be a graph or a table or another result that I didn't tell you about, and it may have some details that you want to know about. So in today's episode, we reviewed the 2024 study from the Joint Center of Housing at Harvard University. I told you a little bit about the study itself, went over some of the conclusions of the study, and then talked about what to do with some of this information. I find these studies are really helpful when choosing what to do next in my rental business, and maybe look in my local area of what's coming next. Either way, I hope you learned something. I'm such a book nerd that I love getting into the source documents of things like this study. And oh, by the way, when I'm buying new properties, guess where I get my information that proposes to the lenders and saying, hey, this is what Harvard says is going on. You think that gives me credibility? Of course it does. For my Canadian friends listening, the Canada study is coming up. Some of the conclusions are the same in Canada, but many of the details are different, and the study is structured very differently. So I will go through that with you. Let me know your comments and questions by emailing me at learn@mylifeasalandlord.com. Check out the free resources on our website, mylifeasalandlord.com, including two free blackout bingo cards. Join me next week for episode 69, when I have the landlady, Wendy Myers, back on the show talking to us all about Section 8 and other rental wisdom. I'll see you there.
Thanks for joining us this week. For all the show notes and resources, check out mylifeasalandlord.com. Want to invest further in your landlord education? We've got a toolbox for you, wherever you are in your journey. Make sure you follow the podcast on the platform you're listening on. Thank you again for joining me, Dr. Jennifer Salisbury, in this episode of My Life as a Landlord. I'll see you next time.